And I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, saying, "Come and see."
Noise of Thunder Radio with Christian J. Pinto.
Okay, praise the Lord, you guys, and welcome. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Today on the show, we are going to talk about the Jesuits and the Rwanda genocide. The Jesuits and the Rwanda genocide. You know, this is a very, very important event historically for a variety of reasons. Remember, the Rwanda genocide happened back in 1994. So, it's one thing to talk about the activities of Rome and the order during World War II. We have lots of controversy, but again, that's you're back in the 1930s and 40s. One thing to talk about St. Bartholomew's Day Massacre, the Irish Massacre of 1641, all of these different controversial events that are so far in the past. But 1994 is really not that far in the past at all. I mean, at this point, it's almost 30 years. But many of the people who were around back then are still alive. For example, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton, the Clinton administration, a lot of the people from the Clinton administration are still alive and operating in the world in a variety of different places. But the Clinton administration, I think, plays a key role, and to understand what they did and what they did not do is very important, because the Clinton administration was built almost entirely from Georgetown University. Clinton himself came out of Georgetown University, and it's even though he himself is a Protestant, you know, from a Baptist background, that he has been a pawn of the order is shown by so many different things that he and Hillary have been a part of. In particular, not just the association with Georgetown, but then they basically chose all of these Georgetown University graduates and people to fill the Clinton administration. But things get very, very specific when you learn that Bill Clinton spoke at the funeral of Martin McGuinness, the former leader of the IRA, Irish Republican Army, there in Northern Ireland. The IRA, there's no question, was a Jesuit operation through and through. And they were the radicals who were responsible for the acts of violence and the bombings and things like that, using the pressure tactics to say, well, we need to share power with the Protestant authorities there in Northern Ireland. Never mind the fact that the Catholics had all of Southern Ireland. You know, they had a much, much bigger portion of Ireland itself. It's just that Northern Ireland in the Ulster area, that was the area that was most successful. And of course, the Jesuits and Rome have never been content with the idea that any part of Ireland would not be in submission to the Pope. And that from the beginning, going back to the Irish Rebellion or Irish Massacre of 1641, that was always the issue. At least according to historians like J.A. Wiley and your modern Protestant movement there in that part of the world. So the Clinton administration was in power with Georgetown University professor Madeleine Albright as the ambassador, United States ambassador to the UN, to the United Nations, when all of this happened. And their actions become very, very telling, what they did and what they did not do. But the reason why I wanted to do this show is because of all the research that I've been doing for the new documentary, American Jesuits, and showing the impact of having Jesuits involved in our deep state, involved in the politics of Washington, D.C., where they are very, very heavily involved. Very involved. I mean, and with the Biden administration, especially. The Biden administration is a Jesuit administration at work in Washington, D.C. That is what we are beholding even today. And the methods that are being employed, for example, against President Trump, bringing him up on these absurd charges so that they can prevent him from running for office in 2024, which if it is what it appears to be, it appears to be an attempt to sabotage the 2024 Trump campaign for president. Why? Because they had to do so much work to rig the 2020 election. My suspicion is, and I admit this is my suspicion, it's my conspiracy theory, that it took them so much effort to rig the 2020 election, they don't want to have to go through it again in 2024. I think they feel like they got away with it one time, they forced it on everybody, etc., that Trump is going to have, he's going to have way, way, way more supporters than Biden. And for them to try and balance it out and to try and make it look like Biden won a second time is just going to be too difficult. That's what I think. I could be wrong. Maybe they've got a way of rigging it that we don't know about. But I don't think that Biden the first time round got anywhere near the amount of votes that President Trump got. 75 million votes is what President Donald Trump received in the 2020 election. And Biden supposedly got 81 million votes. Nobody in their right mind thinks that Biden actually got 81 million votes. He was a terrible candidate. He insulted a lot of different people. Why would anyone vote for him? Of course, the only people who really voted for Biden were people who were anti-Trump. Those are the people who voted for Biden. And typically, that's not going to get somebody elected. So I believe they had to rig it in 2020. I believe they don't want to go through all that work in 2024. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that the whole thing is, as a friend of mine says, Jesuit theater. That they, for whatever reason, are manipulating the country as part of a greater agenda. And all of this stuff with Trump is going to end up being much ado about nothing. They're bringing him up on these charges and whatnot, but ultimately it's going to go nowhere. The case will fall apart, and they're using it to make out Trump to be some kind of martyr figure as part of a greater agenda that we don't fully understand right now. That's also another possibility. Yet another possibility is that they want to somehow or other get Trump out of the way so that they can make room for Ron DeSantis to stand in his place as the Republican candidate in 2024. And given the things that some of the globalists have said about Governor DeSantis, it's very possible that they want him to be the next president. That's a possibility. We'll have to wait and see what happens. But DeSantis is not what he appears to be. He appears to be this conservative, traditional American guy, and he's a very likable fellow. He is. But he was raised in a very devout Catholic background, and I do believe that he is ultimately a pawn for globalism. That's what I believe. And you just look at some of the things that he's done. He's making certain conservative decisions, but he's not really addressing the problems in any kind of meaningful way. We only have people, right? Even Trump, in that regard, President Trump is sort of slowing problems down when he was in the White House, but he's not actually stopping things from happening. He doesn't stop the LGBT agenda. The LGBT agenda should be completely removed from our schools, colleges, and universities. The whole concept of LGBT rights, quote-unquote rights, should be driven out of our courts and out of our halls of government because it's completely contrary to the Constitution of the United States. But we don't have anyone, as far as I can see, in a significant role politically who is going to stand up and say there is no such thing as gay rights under our Constitution. Rights come from God based on the laws of nature, and nature's God, and homosexuality is simply not a constitutional right under any circumstances whatsoever. But we're not seeing anybody make that argument, not in the mainstream. Okay, so bring this all back to our subject matter today, which is on the Jesuits and the Rwanda genocide. If you study the history of what went on over a period of 20 and 30 years in Rwanda leading up to the genocide of 1994, once you know the details, and we're going to go over some of them today on the program, you are going to be able to see the same manipulations that went on in Rwanda leading up to 1994. Many of those same manipulations are happening in the United States of America today. Our country is being manipulated toward, ultimately, a genocidal conclusion. I mean, it's horrific to imagine it. But when you got people talking about re-education camps, you got people talking about quarantine camps and this kind of thing, I mean, woe unto us if we don't take it seriously. And shame on us if we don't take it seriously. We have to take it seriously because these things have happened in too many different parts of the world for us to tell ourselves as Americans that it could not happen here. We owe it to ourselves, our families, and our fellow citizens to pay attention, be on the alert. Even the Bible says, take heed that no man deceive you. Jesus says that. The Apostle Paul says, take heed that no man deceive you by any means. Paul talks about the wiles of the devil, says we are not ignorant of his wiles. Yes, the enemy has wiles. In the past, I have made reference to the book of Esther, how there was a plot to mass murder the Jewish people in the ancient world. And once that plot was revealed to Queen Esther, she doesn't ignore it. She takes action. She does what she can do to try and prevent it from happening. And I believe there is an ongoing plot against Christians and conservatives and anyone in our country who actually believes in the constitutional republic that we have. There is a plot to round these people up and mass murder them. And it is very similar to the circumstances that existed in Rwanda. So we're going to be quoting in no small part from a work that was published in 2020, relatively recent. And this was published in the Kennesaw Journal of Undergraduate Research with Kennesaw State University. Kennesaw State University. And the article is called When Priests Forgot About God: An Analysis of the Catholic Church's Role in Genocide by Mary M. Fertitta, F-E-R-T-I-T-T-A, Mary M. Fertitta. Now, I want to start by reading her introductory comments here. And this was a paper that she wrote for undergraduate research. That's what it says, the Kennesaw Journal of Undergraduate Research. Volume 7, back in 2020. But here's the opening comments at the beginning. It says, quote, the Catholic Church in Rwanda for more than a century was a witness to the atrocities of genocide. 1 million Rwandans died in 100 days while many Catholic priests and nuns stood by offering no assistance. Others participated in the slaughter. The majority of those killed were killed in churches or on church grounds. Since Belgium's acquisition of Rwanda, there have been ties between the Catholic Church and the government of Rwanda. The Catholic Church blamed Belgium for the ethnic class designations and for disturbing the native culture. The church and priests, however, remained silent and maintained their silence to keep teaching and practicing in Rwanda. While over 60,000 were charged in connection with the genocide, imprisoned for hate crimes, and later released, fewer than 20, including priests and nuns, were tried and sentenced. Fewer than 20 people in the final analysis for the mass murder of more than a million people. And you get different numbers on how many people were killed in the genocide. Some people say it was about 800,000. That's typically the number that is given. However, the official number from the government of Rwanda, the official Rwandan government documents, now this is according to survivorsfund.org.uk, and it says that, quote, official Rwandan government documents estimate that the number of people killed in the genocide is 1,074,017. So just over a million people. That is the number officially given by the Rwandan government today. And we can only assume that that is in the aftermath, that the initial numbers were estimates, and in the aftermath, as they've counted all of the people that they found, we can only imagine that that is where the final number came from. A terrible, terrible tragedy. And the role of the players, whether it's the Roman Catholic Church in Rwanda, the United Nations, and, in fact, the Clinton administration, all of it is a very tangled web. I believe the common denominator is the Jesuit order and the historic manipulation of the country of Belgium. Belgium, that's where the European Union is based out of, the EU. Belgium. Belgium is a very, very Catholic country. All right, but let's go to a commercial break, and we will talk more about the Jesuits and the Rwanda genocide when we come back right after this.
Adullam Films presents a stunning new documentary, The True Christian History of America, exploring the Bible-based Christian origins of the early American view of freedom, tracing the principles of liberty back to England and the Great Reformation. For many years, our schools have taught that the founding of our republic was from the deists, or the Enlightenment in France. But is that truly the case? Did the Enlightenment first declare no taxation without representation or trial by jury? Were they the champions of freedom of speech or of the press or the right to bear arms? And why did Samuel Adams declare that the reign of political Protestantism would commence just before signing the Declaration of Independence? Filmed on location in both the United States and Europe, The True Christian History of America is now available at adullamfilms.com. That's adullamfilms.com. Now available at noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com.
Adullam Films presents an exciting new documentary, Bridge to Babylon, part three in an award-winning series on the untold history of the Bible. Dr. Jack Moorman calls it a masterful presentation of what is the single most important issue facing Christians today, the defense of the Bible as the Word of God. Why was the Bible changed in 1881? Why have so many churches abandoned biblical inerrancy? And what direction are scholars taking the Scriptures today? Learn the truth in Bridge to Babylon, the sequel to A Lamp in the Dark and Tares Among the Wheat. Bridge to Babylon is now available at noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com.
Noise of Thunder Radio.
Okay, we are back. Praise the Lord, you guys. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Thanks for staying with the show today. Today we are talking about, well, we're talking about the Rwanda genocide. Now, why are we talking about it? Because this month, April, beginning really on the 6th of April, is the anniversary of the beginning of the Rwanda genocide. So it is appropriate to remind people of what happened back in 1994. Now, I'm going to read a quote. This is from the South African missionary, Dr. Peter Hammond. And he sent out an article not long ago from their Frontline Fellowship newsletter called Lessons from the Rwandan Holocaust. And he said this, quote, "The assassination of Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana," I'm probably saying that wrong, "but the assassination of the Rwandan president by a French heat-seeking missile fired by his own presidential guard on 6 April 1994 was the pretext to launch the well-prepared genocide of the mostly Protestant Tutsis. Government forces set up a dense network of roadblocks and mobilized Interahamwe mobs to systematically go house to house massacring Tutsis. At roadblocks, those identified as Tutsi were pulled out and hacked to death on the spot." Okay. Now, notice what Dr. Hammond says here. And Dr. Hammond, if you listen to his testimony, he was in Rwanda shortly after the genocide took place. He wanted to go there because he's based in Africa. So he went to where the genocide had happened. And part of his testimony is walking waist deep in dead bodies in churches and things like that. So he saw the horrors that were there. And many of you know, I had the opportunity to interview him. He appears in our film, The True Christian History of America. He gives a great, great testimony. But part of the history of his missionary work is he was there shortly after the genocide happened. Now, this is why I find his testimony so powerful and interesting, because he's based in that part of the world. But notice what he says, the prepared genocide of the mostly Protestant Tutsis. Mostly Protestant Tutsis. How is it that the Hutus, which there's no question were being controlled by the hierarchy of the Roman Catholic Church. And we're going to be going over some of those details. Now, just so you know, I'm going to cover part of this on this radio program, but the real details with videotape footage and the historic evidence is going to be part of our film. This is going to be a chapter in our film on American Jesuits. And the reason is because what was happening in Rwanda was directly affected by Washington, D.C. and the Clinton administration that was largely controlled by Georgetown University, which is the Jesuits' headquarters in D.C. And we give you all the documentation. In fact, if you wanted to, you can go online and you can begin to investigate, those of you who want to do research, investigate the Edmund Walsh School of Foreign Service there at Georgetown University. That is reportedly where they train the spies for the CIA. We got a number of articles written on that. But we'll be talking more about that. I had a chance to go filming while I was in Washington, D.C. And actually, I was there several years ago doing some filming in D.C. I've been there multiple times, but on one occasion I went to Georgetown and got some great footage of this Jesuit headquarters, which just appears like a prominent, prestigious university. But of course, they've got a statue of Ignatius Loyola there walking with his staff, a bronze memorial to him, which, if you know the history of the order, that tells you what's really going on. But yes, that's where they train the spies. They train CIA operatives out of Georgetown University. Now, remember that Georgetown University graduates and people from Georgetown, one way or the other, people like Madeleine Albright, who was a professor at Georgetown University, and she was part of the Clinton administration. Here is a headline from an article in Salon magazine, online, salon.com. And the headline says, quote, "Forgotten scandal, how the U.S. prevented UN action on Rwandan genocide under Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright." Bill Clinton and Madeleine Albright. Okay. Both out of Georgetown University and went out of their way to prevent anybody from stopping this genocide from happening, because you have to realize they knew it was going to happen months before it happened. All the evidence is there. Stockpiling arms, stockpiling machetes, especially. The whole thing was planned and orchestrated, and not just by the Hutus, who were the killers. They were the kill squads that went out and just massacred Tutsis all over the country. But by political forces at work in both in Rwanda and also the United Nations and in the Clinton administration. That is what makes the whole thing very, very disturbing. Now, you've got another article on the website Democracy Now! And the headline says, "The Rwanda Genocide, How Does Madeleine Albright Live With Herself?" How does Madeleine Albright live with herself? Here's a quote from the article. It says, quote, "Madeleine Albright, with a zeal which was virtually supernatural, pursued the mandate of preventing the UN from entering Rwanda in large numbers. She did it with a determined, methodical prosecution of her brief in a way few ambassadors do." And that's a quote taken from a fellow ambassador, Ambassador Stephen Lewis. So here's a guy who himself is an ambassador. And he says that what Madeleine Albright did with a zeal that was virtually supernatural. When I read that, my interpretation of that is this is Jesuitism. She went out of her way to make sure that the United Nations could not prevent the massacre from happening, that it would happen. Now, who would do that? This is all part of this post-World War II globalist strategy. This is their technique. I call it sometimes the stand-down technique. And I developed that term. If you think of Oliver Stone's film JFK, where they're planning the assassination of John F. Kennedy, and they have that scene where all of these commanders are making phone calls, and some commander says, "You will stand down." In other words, the security detail that's supposed to protect the president from being harmed is going to stand down. So that's part of the technique. To order whoever it is that's supposed to protect, you get those people out of the way. You get them to stand down, and then whatever you want to happen can happen. This is what happened with the Black Lives Matter and Antifa riots. They're running around burning everything to the ground. Where's the police? Well, they were ordered to stand down. We've got millions of people coming across our southern border. Where are the security forces? They've been ordered to stand down. You see, this is what they're doing over and over and over again. Then they take it to a personal level when they disarm the common people, because what they're and not only disarm them, but then remove your right of self-defense. This is what they've done in Canada, what they've done in England, Australia, New Zealand, all these different countries. Even if you, in some limited circumstances, are allowed to own a firearm, you are told by law, you cannot use a firearm to defend yourself. You cannot use it for self-defense. Now, this has been a big controversy up in Canada here recently, and there's mixed messages coming out of Canada. But I want to play this just a little bit of audio from a news report on this, where a man shot a home intruder in self-defense, very clear case of self-defense, and yet he was still charged with murder by the police. Listen.
Many questions tonight about a home invasion west of Toronto. What started out as an attempted robbery led to an occupant of the home being charged with murder. As CTV's Heather Wright reports, many are wondering about the right to protect yourself in your own home.
At around 5 a.m. on Sunday, shots were fired inside this home in Milton, Ontario. Police say the victim was part of a group trying to rob the home and was killed by the man who lives here. The resident, 22-year-old Ali Meehan, who lives here with his mother, has been charged with second-degree murder.
He definitely has a right to defend himself, and that's going to be his defense, obviously, his self-defense, right? Armed intruders in his home invasion, and defending himself and his mother. So we'll see what happens.
One man has been charged with breaking and entering in unauthorized possession of a firearm, while three suspects fled in a light-colored Dodge Charger. Forensic investigators have been at the house trying to piece together the sequence of events.
It sounds like a knee-jerk reaction.
Edward Berlew is a lawyer and says he's surprised to see a murder charge laid so quickly.
You can meet force with force. And when somebody's coming at you with deadly force, you can meet them with deadly force.
Under Section 34 of the Criminal Code, a person is not guilty of an offense if the act is committed for the purpose of defending or protecting themselves or the other person, and that the act is reasonable in the circumstances.
Now, what we're hearing some of the lawyers say there, and what the code, based on this report, is saying, is consistent with Castle Doctrine and consistent with Exodus chapter 22, which we've talked about before. We talk about it in our film, True Christian History. God's law is very, very clear. If a thief is found breaking into a person's home and the homeowner strikes the thief in such a way that the thief dies, the homeowner is not to be charged with the death of the thief. That's what the law of God says. And in this case, especially because there wasn't just one guy, there were apparently three, and they break in and one of them has a gun, clearly intending to use deadly force, if necessary, to get whatever he wants. And so, we agree, obviously. The Bible agrees with what these attorneys are saying and what the law appears to be there in Canada on paper anyway. But listen to this quote from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Hear what Justin Trudeau had to say in response to this whole issue. Listen.
And there are debates. And we have a culture where the difference is guns can be used for hunting or for sport shooting in Canada. And there's lots of gun owners, and they're mostly respecting and law-abiding. But you can't use a gun for self-protection in Canada. That's not a right that you have in the Constitution or anywhere else. If you try and buy a gun and say it's for self-protection, no, you don't get that. You get it for hunting. You can get it for sport shooting. You can take it to the range. No problem, as long as you go through our rigorous background checks. But there's a difference around the culture. And one of the things that we're seeing with the debate in the States is you get more and more of the American-style, you know, right to carry, self-defense arguments filtering up through the usual more right-wing communications channels.
Yeah.
All right, so that seems to be the disconnect from what we heard in the story, where Canada seems to have a law based on the testimony of the lawyers that we just heard from in that report, and the report of what the law itself says there in Canada that seems to favor self-defense. But now we hear from Prime Minister Justin Trudeau that says you don't have the right to use a firearm for self-defense. So is that the real issue? It should be very interesting to see how this whole case unfolds there in Canada. And this comes back to, I now understand what Colonel Jeff Cooper meant years ago when he coined the phrase hoplophobia. Hoplophobia is the irrational fear of guns. And so you have these globalists, these leftists, these communists, really, who have been brainwashing people to think that there's something especially bad with a gun. And this takes us back to, it's almost like they'll say things like, well, the deaths by gun rate is down. Now, that doesn't mean the homicide rate is down or the murder rate is down. It just means the deaths by guns rate, as though that's something to celebrate, even if the murder rate increases. But this self-defense issue and the right to bear arms issue was very much a part of what happened in the Rwanda genocide, because the people of Rwanda were disarmed before they were mass murdered. This is from an article by Dave Capel, the research director of the Independence Institute. He has an article online called Gun Bans and Genocide, The Disarming Facts. And he talks about a lot of these countries in Africa. And he starts with the Sudan. He says, quote, Sudan is covered by a UN-backed treaty called the Nairobi Protocol for the Prevention, Control, and Reduction of Small Arms and Light Weapons in the Great Lakes region and the Horn of Africa. Now, this protocol is from 2004, so it's a protocol developed after the Rwanda genocide. But see, the Rwanda genocide should be a lesson to everybody. They were killing an average, it is said, of 10,000 people per day. 10,000 people per day. And they were using machetes to do it. They didn't need guns. They were killing people with the machetes. Now, here is a quote from Dr. Peter Hammond. I want to give you that number from this quote from Dr. Hammond. It says, quote, the Genocide Museum in Kigali, that's in Rwanda, calculates that during the 100 days of the genocide, an average of 10,000 people were murdered every day, 400 every hour, and 7 every minute. That's what it breaks down to. 10,000 people slaughtered every day, primarily with machetes. So you know that's why I say this whole idea of hoplophobia, the irrational fear of guns. Oh, guns are so bad. Oh, bad things will happen with guns. You don't need guns. They use machetes. People have been killing. Massacres have been taking place for thousands of years, long before firearms were ever developed. So it's this irrational idea that somehow or other guns are especially bad. Well, guns in a situation like the Rwanda genocide, if the Tutsis had been armed with firearms, they could have prevented themselves from being butchered. All right, so just one more quote from this article, this other article by Dave Capel. He says, quote, the UN is successfully pushing for gun control in East African nations with current genocides, where they have ongoing persecution and people being mass murdered. And he mentions the Sudan, the Congo, and Ethiopia. Then he says, quote, several others such as Rwanda and Uganda have recent histories of genocide against disarmed victims. Against disarmed victims. He says, quote, quite plainly, the UN believes that resisting an actual genocide in progress is not a sufficient reason for someone to want to own a gun. So you're not supposed to want to own a firearm so that you can resist having yourself, your family, and your neighbors genocided. And of course, this is where the mentality of somebody like Justin Trudeau comes from. That's why he's a globalist. That supposedly you cannot use a firearm to defend yourself. Now, ask yourself the question, do you think that Prime Minister Trudeau, who has armed guards around him pretty much all day, do you think those armed guards who have firearms could use their firearms to defend the prime minister if they wanted to? Undoubtedly, they could. Undoubtedly, firearms could be employed to defend the members of the Canadian government and pretty much all the other governments that are denying an individual's right to defend themselves using a firearm, which is simply this irrational argument that has developed post-World War II, especially. Also, remember that here in the United States, as we've talked about before, America Magazine, years ago, the Jesuits published their article, Repeal the Second Amendment. That's the headline, Repeal the Second Amendment. They want to disarm the people of America. Thankfully, we have many, many American patriots, millions of American patriots, who are not just going to hand over their firearms. They're absolutely refusing to do that and resisting in a whole variety of different ways, which we believe is a very good thing because it keeps these tyrannical forces at bay, it keeps them back. Okay, so let's go back and look at now this article, When Priests Forgot About God, the article in the Kennesaw Journal on the role of the Roman Catholic Church in the Rwandan genocide. So here is what the article says. A quote, in 1952, Jesuit missionaries went to work in Rwanda at the request of King Mutara III. They focused on feeding the poor and educating the children. The Jesuit missionaries educated the Hutus. The Hutus, remember, the Hutus were the ones who ultimately carried out the massacre in 1994 against the Tutsis, who were generally Protestant. So Jesuit missionaries educated the Hutus. In 1955, the Belgian government directed the Jesuits to move their school from Rwanda to Usambura, Burundi. Apparently there was some conflict between the Belgian government and the Jesuits. And so they had to move their school for a time. And then it says, quote, the Catholic Church and local priests in Rwanda again declared discrimination unfair to the Hutu and spoke out in their defense. So a lot of the propaganda, if you study this whole thing, between the Hutu and the Tutsis, remember, both groups are black. But it didn't matter. They're arguing that the Tutsis were unfairly discriminating against the Hutu. The Hutus were not properly represented. There was not proper amount of power sharing, etc., etc. All of this very, very typical. Whenever you hear these arguments, this is Jesuitism. Okay, so it says, quote, the Jesuits did not return to Rwanda until 1966, and they did so to open an elementary and high school in Kigali. The church also opened a novitiate, making Kigali the center for religious education. Now, I can tell you, Kigali, that is the city where the genocide began. It all began in Kigali, okay, which was apparently became the Jesuit headquarters in Rwanda. All right. Then you keep reading the article, and it says at the instigation of the Roman Catholic Church, quote, 11 politically powerful Hutu elite wrote a declaration demanding a resolution to the inequality and racial discrimination. Sound familiar? Remember, both groups are black. But they went in and they discovered racial differences between them. The primary difference was the shape of their noses. And if you really want to see a breakdown of that, watch the documentary In God's Name, because there they show literally the measuring of the nose of the Hutu versus measuring the nose of the Tutsi. The Hutu had the wider, more flat-looking noses, and the Tutsi had the more narrow, longer noses. I mean, literally. and they called it nose politics, how you recognize one group from another. And they went out of their way to make sure everybody understood these racial differences. So this kind of discord, the Roman Catholic Church, and if you study them in our country, not just Jesuits, Jesuits primarily, but also Catholic priests, are very involved in racial agitation. And they the way that they stir things up is they find their group that they want to empower. Basically, the group that's going to be the front men for them, who will do what they want them to do. And they basically say, if you listen to us, the Catholic priesthood, we will put you in power. And we will get you money. We'll get you all the stuff you need. You just need to cooperate with us and do what we tell you to do. And then they start making these arguments about inequality and how you have to address the inequality and it has to be political. And so that means you have to take power away from the people who are obviously a bunch of racists and whatever. And it doesn't have anything to do with being white. You see, here in America, we think, wow, it's all about being white. No, it's not necessarily about being white. It's about people wanting power and control. That's what this is about. So under the guidance of Roman Catholic leaders, these Hutu elitists, they come up with a declaration. And the article says, quote, in their declaration, they listed out expected solutions. This 9-page document dated March 3rd, 1957, was called the Manifesto of the Bahutu. So they come up with a manifesto, kind of like the Communist Manifesto. You might also compare this with the Black Lives Matter Manifesto or Black Lives Matter Demands. They've had all of these different statements that they publish making demands about certain things. And if you study what happened in Rwanda, it was this progressive movement. They were constantly demanding more and more and more to get rid of the Tutsis, ultimately, to take power from the Tutsis, redistribute power away from the Tutsis into the hands of the Hutu. Black Lives Matter. They have their BLM demands, blacklivesmatter.com. You go there, BLM's 7 demands. What's the number one demand? Number one demand, quote, convict and ban Trump from future political office. That's their number one demand. What's happening right now? Well, they've got President Trump under indictment. They've charged him. They're claiming that if he's found guilty, he could be spending over 100 years in prison. Number two demand, they say, expel Republican members of Congress who attempted to overturn the election and incited a white supremacist attack. Yeah, it almost kind of looks like what's going on is in line with this Black Lives Matter demand list. You see, but the organization of this largely comes at the instigation of Rome. Rome, they are the masters of this kind of manipulation. They know how to twist and turn the politics. Because the thing that you have to remember about Black Lives Matter, when they're smashing and burning everything, the fact that they're not being held accountable, how is that happening? That is because there are forces behind the scenes that want them to do what they are doing. That's why. And if you read this article on what happened with the Roman Catholic Church in Rwanda, there was systematic, ongoing persecution of the Tutsis. Okay? I'm going to read. These are my notes on the article. At one point, she says, quote, by the early 1970s, the Catholic Church started to make changes focusing on the Hutu. The Hutu continued to complain about unfair education advantages given to Tutsi. Hutus also claimed that they could not find employment because the Tutsi were taking Hutu positions in schools and jobs. At the National University, Hutu students took it upon themselves to post flyers telling all Tutsi to leave the school. Not unlike what we're seeing, where you have black students that tell the whites to get out. Tell the whites, don't go to Harvard and Yale, etc. You owe it to black students to go there. They all need to go there, not you. This is what they're doing. The exact same thing. Then she goes on to talk about how they had affirmative action type programs through, quote, ethnic quota status in the schools and businesses. Ethnic quota status. In other words, a skin quota. You've got to make sure that you have a certain number of people from a certain racial background in this school here, in businesses there, etc. These are affirmative action type tactics. They use these all over the place. Not based on qualifications, not based on who's the most qualified, but what color is your skin? What is your race? And at the same time, this is being done with violence and threats, etc. And so the article says, quote, thousands of Tutsi and sympathizing Hutu were forced into exile to save their lives because there was ongoing persecution even before 1994. Think about what's happening in our country. There's continual aggression and assault and threats and intimidation, everything else, more and more demands. Not just from Black Lives Matter, because now we're dealing with more than that. We got Black Lives Matter. We got Antifa. We've got this transgender movement that is becoming increasingly radical and more violent. In America, they've got, I think, a greater collection of seditious and subversive groups that are scratching and clawing for power. But they all tend to see the same enemy. God-fearing Christian people who believe in the Constitution, who are generally white, but not exclusively so. If you're black, if you're Latino, if you are Jewish, and you believe in the Constitution, and you're generally conservative, you're on the list. That's why I found this quote when she mentions Tutsi and sympathizing Hutu. Not all of the Hutu were horrible. Some of them were sympathetic. They felt bad for the Tutsi. They could see they were being wrongly persecuted and mistreated. But what happened was the other Hutu, the radical Hutu, they would come in and say, nope, that's not going to work. We don't want any sympathy. You have any sympathy, then you're the enemy. That's key. All right, now here's a quote, because we're coming to the toward the end of the program here. And here's a quote. It says, quote, by the fall of 1994, the church was doing some soul searching, by which she means the Catholic Church, was doing some soul searching and could write, quote, the Catholic Church has been in the service of General Habarimana's power. That's the Hutu leader. This is the accusation one constantly hears against the Rwandese church. And it is unfortunately true. The Hague Conference in mid-September 1994 had been an educational experience in watching some viscerally anti-Tutsi Belgian Christians at work, by which they mean Catholics. The Catholic Church has been in the service of basically the Tutsi leaders' power. The author goes on to say, quote, many survivors and Rwanda's current government insist that there are still other priests and nuns who were killers. Some witnesses recall that there were priests who had guns and shot people. Another priest had his church bulldozed while full of people, crushing them to death. Other witnesses remembered that another priest, Father Jean-Baptiste Rudehunza, slaughtered Tutsi children who were disabled at the Center for the Handicapped in Gatagara. The article goes on. It says, quote, Emmanuel Rokundo, Roman Catholic priest and Hutu extremist, betrayed the trust of the Tutsi people seeking safety and hiding in a seminary. Witnesses stated that Rokundo pointed out to the soldiers on four separate occasions where people were hiding. The Hutu militia subsequently murdered these people. Rokundo was prosecuted, tried by the United Nations Tribunal, and sentenced to 25 years in prison. And there's all kinds of other stories. Some of these stories are just incredibly horrific, but the pattern of behavior was that the Catholic priests and the nuns would often go out and gather Tutsis and tell them, come with me and I'll protect you, and bring them into a church or some kind of Catholic center for something. And once all the people got in there, then the Hutus would show up. Why? Because they planned it that way. And then the Tutsis would discover too late, of course, that the Catholic priests or nuns had tricked them, led them into a trap, and then they were all massacred. That happened over and over and over again. It is a frightening and very, very disturbing, tragic chapter in modern history, but all of the elements are there that, yes, this or something like this can happen yet again, because the same powers are at work. They're using the same methods. Yes, they're using these methods right here in the United States of America. Thankfully, we've got a lot of patriots and more citizens who are waking up to what's going on, and they recognize the danger. And people are trying to ready themselves, and they're pushing back in a variety of ways. Now, I'm not a fatalist. So I don't believe, oh, there's nothing we can do. No, I believe there are things we can do. And with God's help, yes, we can prevail. So I'm not a fatalist. And part of the reason I point these things out is not to engage in scaremongering any more than Mordecai engaged in scaremongering by speaking to Queen Esther about the plot of Haman to kill all the Jews back in the book of Esther. No, the reason for pointing these things out and the parallels and the potential danger is so that we as Christians can be aware of what's happening, and through that awareness, take action, speak out, stand up, and make sure that we don't allow these kind of conditions and this kind of environment to be created here in the United States. But see, what they're doing with things like the 1619 Project and critical race theory, all of that is aimed in this direction, because they were brainwashing the Hutus and the children in the schools for decades before the genocide of 1994. This all goes back to the 1950s. Notice from the dates. But I believe the time to stop it is before they are able to indoctrinate and stir up and sow the kind of racial discord and agitation and hatred that they rely upon to carry out these genocides and holocausts, because it's a pattern of working, and we've seen it again and again and again. So my hope and my prayer is that the Lord will grant us wisdom and guidance for what we ought to do here in America to make sure that something like this never, ever, ever happens. All right, brethren, that is going to do it for us today. That is our show. We are going to stop it there, but we will be back next time as the Lord leads us. Until then, God bless you guys. I'm Chris Pinto, and you've been listening to Noise of Thunder Radio.